Today, this is the only place in all the world to be. Gee, but it's good to be here.
Frankly, coming up on Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway, we talk about Clive at the New Group, which is directed and starring Ethan Hawke. We also talk about the York Theatre Company's Musicals and Mufti series and the upcoming rest of the Broadway season, so please stay tuned.
I really feel in raffle. There's nothing like this, not anywhere. There's a magic that fills the air. I'm so ecstatic, I could yell, I could dance about. To be emphatic, I could shout, 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 shout it out. Oh, gee, but
hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, February 10th, 2013. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books, his most recent being the Broadway MVPs 1960 to 2010, the most valuable players of the past 50 seasons. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places throughout the internet. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at TalkinBroadway.com, the Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He's also a photographer whose work can be seen at FileSpotPhoto.com and many other places around the internet. Hello, Michael.
Good morning.
So we are post-storm. All pretty much people are pretty dug out. I'm pretty dug out. And the we were just joking before we started recording that everybody in Manhattan is doing pretty good too. So this week, Peter got to see the show Clive. So Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Clive is by Jonathan Mark Sherman, a playwright I've admired for quite some time. What he's done, he's taken Bertolt Brecht. Play Baal, B-A-A-L, he's updated it. He's brought it certainly into the 1990s, as the playbill says. But you can also hear the future and the past. That's what it says when it says the time, the 1990s, but you can also hear the future and the past. We're in New York and Canada, and he's right. You can, because what this is a story of is Clive, who leads a dissolute life. And what we see is that's what comes from too much pills and liquor. Sex, drugs, and rock and roll, that's what Clive is into, and he's having a wonderful time, and he sees no ramifications coming. But a dissolute life certainly does have its ramifications. Even though he seems to believe that he's immune to any problem, and he's certainly getting the ladies because, after all, so many women are attracted to bad boys, whether they should be or not, and he gets his share there. Though, as someone points out in the play, he's more and more disgusting as every day passes. Yes, he is. Yes, he is. He also picks up a lot of friends along the way. The reason I paused is so you could put in the quotation marks around the word friends, because they aren't friends at all. They're false friends. They're barely acquaintances. And certainly when times get tough for Clive, and they do, they're not there for him. And really, he couldn't expect them to be, because frankly, he wouldn't have been there for them either. So that's what this is. It's an hour and 40 minutes of a man's descent into his own private hell. It's effective. I found it gripping, no, but I did find it a show that did hold my attention, as if it seemed a little, wow, see, it's hard for me really to even put this into words. What I really want to say is that as much as I was interested in watching it, and as much as it kept my attention, I did start thinking about David Mamet's play Edmund. And that's a play where a guy goes on a very strange rampage and winds up paying a heavy price for it too. Not as heavy as Clive, I'll admit, but pretty heavy indeed. And I thought, you know, Here's Jonathan Mark Sherman taking a Brecht play, but David Mamet did it from scratch in essence, and Edmund interested me more. If you can see the film version of Edmund with William H. Macy, I think you might have a better time than if indeed you wound up with the New Group's production on Theater Row of Clive. Still, if you already have tickets, you're in for an evening that will hold your attention if indeed it doesn't turn out to be one of the great theatrical landmarks of your life.
So what did we think about the direction of Ethan Hawke? Is this something that we can look forward to more stuff from him?
Well, I hope so. Certainly having somebody of Ethan Hawke's caliber on a small stage in Theater Row, and having Vincent D'Onofrio there too, by the way, it certainly is an asset as well. But Ethan Hawke directed this as well, and he certainly had a sure hand in the way that he directed it. He knew exactly what he wanted, and it showed on the stage. I guess there's an inevitability of this type of play when you just see the downward spiral happening. And there is something, it doesn't take long to figure out that this guy's going to come to a bad end. And watching it happen, though, Jonathan Mark Sherman does the best he can considering the inevitability of the plot. And Ethan Hawke certainly does a good job as our dissolute hero and does a good job in staging it. So, it's just we know that this is going to wind up with Ethan Hawke's surviving and thriving. It's not going to happen that way. That's really the problem, the inevitability. But yes, I mean, Ethan Hawke does two jobs in this play and does them both well.
Well, this is an adaptation of a previous play, so I guess it's hard to say. Do you know the original?
I don't.
Yeah, me neither.
You know, when I was a kid in the 60s, I'll tell you, every time you turned around, there was a Brecht play being done. Mm. And yet I just don't see them as much anymore, not as much. Although The Good Person of Szechuan, which I, of course, saw as The Good Woman of Szechuan, many moons ago, is getting done now at La Mama, and I hope to be going this week to that. But the Brecht plays that used to, well, admittedly, I was growing up in Boston, and I wasn't seeing them at the Schubert Colonial in Wilbur. Where I was seeing them was in the college theaters, Harvard, Brandeis, Tufts. That's where they were being done quite a bit. So, but still, I keep in touch to see what these theaters are doing now. When I go back to Boston, you know, what's Harvard doing? What's Brandeis doing? You know, what's Tufts doing? And I don't see Brecht on the roster very often, if at all.
Well, what I was going to say is, it seems just from your description, this might be a case of a play, the original play that was very groundbreaking in its day,
and
the subject matter, the kind of subject matter that really had not been done to that point. But since then, it seems to me we've had hundreds of plays and films on the same general subject matter. So I think maybe it's a case of something that was tremendously influential, but now when we see it, it seems old hat or almost trite, because we've seen so many similar things since then. But those similar things owe so much to the original.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
So, all right. It's it's showing up at the Acorn Theater on Theater Row, as Peter mentioned. It's going through March 9th. So far, they haven't announced any sort of extension. And so get out and see it if it sounds like it might be your bag of toys to play with.
You know what's interesting? Correct me if I'm wrong. Ethan Hawke has acted quite regularly off Broadway in recent years, and he was in The Coast of Utopia at Lincoln Center. But I think that was that his only quote unquote Broadway credit.
No, I recall he was doing Henry IV up there as well.
At Lincoln Center.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, my point is, it seems that he prefers, or whatever. I mean, certainly someone of his stature could probably work more regularly on Broadway if he wanted to. But it seems like he prefers, in the same way that he prefers indie films, I guess
sure.
It's fair to say, to mainstream films. So that's just an interesting...
That's a good point.
Yeah.
You're quite right about that. He does show up off-Broadway substantially more. That's why he got an Obie Award for Blood from a Stone and a Drama Desk nomination for The Winter's Tale. So, yeah, I don't disagree with that at all.
Peter, is he a Theatre World Award winner?
I wish we could claim that. No. I can't say he is. He is an Oscar nominee, which I'm sure brings him far more pleasure. He's, in fact, has two, both as an actor and a writer. So he's done all right there. But no.
Maybe if we got Affleck and Damon to Broadway, we can get those Oscar.
You know, frankly, I always prefer that Theatre World Awards go to people you haven't heard of this time last year, mm-hmm. rather than people who are very famous and just happen to dip their toe onto the Broadway or off-Broadway stage. But nevertheless, we seem to have a mix of both by the time all seven judges vote.
I was wondering if Ethan Hawke might ever consider doing Hamlet on stage. Since he did that film version of it, but I guess if he's going to do it, it should be fairly soon.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to move forward with a discussion of the York Theatre Company's upcoming Musicals and Mufti's series, the concert series. A lot of people don't understand or don't really know what Mufti means. And on the York Theatre Company website, they have an explanation of this. They say Mufti means in street clothes without the usual trappings. So it's kind of a...
Well, much as I love Jim Morgan and much as I love the Mufti series, I always object when he talks about trappings, you know, meaning scenery and costumes. There's nothing wrong with scenery and costumes. I don't think it should have the pejorative term of trappings around it. I like scenery. I like costumes. But I will take what the York gives me, because so many times I have had chances to see musicals that I've never seen before. And in fact, it would seem that this would be one of those times, because they're doing Hollywood Pinafore, which was George S. Kaufman's adaptation of HMS Pinafore set in Hollywood. So, and that was done in the 1944-45 seasons. It never got a cast album because it was a quick failure. He really had great faith in it, though. He thought it was going to run forever. Mm-hmm. It was one of the properties about which he was the most secure, taking Sir Arthur Sullivan's music and writing new lyrics. I'm Poor Little Butter Up, sings the Luella Parsons Hedda Hopper character, who's got a name something like Lou Hedda. You get the point. A conflation of the two names. But I did see this on Park Avenue some years ago, ironically enough. A small company, I think it was Theater 1010, did it. Happy Hunting's hard to see, too. That's Ethel Merman's vehicle from 1956 about Grace Kelly's wedding, about her wanting to go there and get a prince for her daughter, too, even though she's a bit of a parvenu, Ethel's character. And the girl, of course, has ideas of her own. She loves this pauper, and, of course, the Merm is very upset about this. And but it all works out, needless to say. It didn't work out on stage because it was a tremendously troubled production, because Merman and Fernando Lamas did not get along at all. But again, this is what I saw back in the 70s, where there was a group up the street from the Court Theater that did in repertory Happy Hunting and Regina, which you don't expect those two shows to have any type of link whatsoever. You know, Regina, after all, is the opera version of The Little Foxes. But God love them, I guess they felt something for everyone. So, but Michael, you must be looking forward to these too.
Well, yeah, I'm sick about it. I'm going to have to miss 2x2 with Tova Felcha and Jason Alexander because I'm going to be in Florida, and the musicals in Mufti only run for a few performances each. They have really what sounds like stellar casts for each of these shows. maybe it was an obvious choice, but it's also a wonderful one. Mm-hmm. Happy Hunting is going to be have Clea Blackhurst in the Merman role, and she's made quite a name for herself playing Merman roles in several musicals recently. And they're also going to have Andrew Szymanski, who, as I've noted recently, just seems to be very much in demand going from show to show, and Lynn Winterstiller and Joy Franz and Sean Martin Hingston. And then the York is doing a Silk Stockings with Stephen DeRosa and Eric Devine and Michael Kostroff, the wonderful underappreciated, I would say, Cole Porter show. Really, one of his some of his best lyrics, and some really, really, really cute songs in that one.
And the perfect show for its time, by the way, in 1955, seeing a musical in which the Russians, the Soviets, are depicted as oppressive, and there's no freedom to their life, while Americans can certainly have a good, happy time of it, was certainly the right show at the right time. Silk Stockings went through a real tryout hell. The actress playing Janice Dayton came and went and came and went. There were so many people playing it. You could almost field a baseball team with the number of people who were playing that role as time went on. But yes, this is the musical version of Ninotchka, that wonderful 1939 film with Greta Garbo and Melvin Douglas. And it certainly has its assets. And if you know the movie version of Silk Stockings, well, here in this version, the stage version, you will hear some lyrics that you don't get to hear in the movie because they had to be censored. I mean, what could you do? I mean, you couldn't certainly say lines like, "Her bosom's 5 feet wide." It had to be, "Her mouth is 5 feet wide." But my favorite is a lyric that said, talked about Ava Gardner portraying Lady Godiva.
Yeah.
"The people wouldn't pay a cent to see her in the bear," became, "The people wouldn't pay a cent. They wouldn't even care." I mean, the idea of seeing her in the bear was considered too racy a line. The 50s were prudish, weren't
they? I've always thought, can you imagine if those people, you know, who did that censoring could be transported to the current day?
Well, they'd be dead because they dropped dead at seeing what's going on. No question about that.
Well, I just reflect on our previous discussion. The Clive had warnings of nudity on stage and things like that. Was there much of that in the production?
Not at all.
It's so funny because the Ticketmaster or Telecharge, I forget which site it was, had big, huge warnings about nudity on stage in Clive.
Really?
But yeah.
So that's why the performance I went to was sold out. Now I understand.
Well, that's interesting. So you think it was cut, Peter?
Conceivably, but I'll tell you, there was certainly no full frontal nudity that I saw. None.
Mm-hmm. And it was I looked at the title, and not knowing much about the show itself, I was surprised to hear it had nothing to do with Clive Davis.
No.
Who is also announced that he wants to produce My Fair Lady on Broadway.
Now, that's interesting for so many reasons, but one of the chief reasons for me is that, you know, there's supposedly still in development this film remake that Emma Thompson was going to rewrite. And I checked, and it's still listed as in development on IMDb, so I, you know, presumably they're not going to happen at the same time. Maybe that film is dead, even though it's still listed.
Although, other things that were tangential to Broadway is that the movie of Annie that Will Smith was going to make with his daughter Willow,
right?
She has pulled out of the production. Her people got in touch with his people and said, "No, it's probably not.
Yeah.
It's probably not the right time for us to do this." It's interesting to see because it seems like this Annie on Broadway is doing great business in the middle of the winter. It might be around for a little while. I wonder if the film would be released while the Broadway show is going and they're unrelated productions.
Well, I don't know. That's a good point.
I derailed us off of the York Theatre Company's.
Oh, yeah. I wanted to get back to Happy Hunting because that it's really for a show that was basically a flop. It's interesting in several different respects, which I think we've discussed before. The score is by music by Harold Carr and lyrics by Matt Duby, who were quite unknown at the time and pretty much unknown since then. And supposedly because there was a great deal of tsuris about the score of the show. And in fact, as the run progressed, some of the songs were replaced with songs written by Merman's friend Roger Edens.
Mark K. Thompson, some people have said that too. Hillary Knight, who worked with Kay Thompson on the Eloise books, told me that Kay always denied writing anything for Happy Hunting, but there are plenty of sources who said she actually did.
Wrote some or all of the songs that were credited to Roger Edens?
Where she stops, nobody does. Oh, I will say this. When I saw Happy Hunting in the 70s at that little up, you had to go up a steep and very narrow stairway to get to this little black block's place. The opening number was not "Gee, But It's Good to Be Here," a number that Merman would retain and use in her act for the rest of her life. And one often wonders, since she never spoke well of Happy Hunting, why did she retain one of Happy Hunting's song? And that may very well be because either Kay Thompson or Roger Edens, or both for all we know, wrote it. What they did in that production of Happy Hunting was go back to the original song called "The International Set Yet," meaning that type of colloquial expression where you're belittling the international set yet, that type of thing. Though at the end of the song, she comes to the conclusion that I will lick the international set yet. So it's a nice difference in the way the word yet is used. So, and I remember that night, Matt Duby was in the audience and took a bow. And one has to wonder if he said, okay, you can do Happy Hunting, but I want you to do the Happy Hunting that I wrote.
Wow.
There was that famous incident. Sometimes it's attributed to Duby, sometimes it's attributed to Carr. But early on, one of them said to her, Miss Merman, if I wanted my music to be sung that way, I would have written it that way. And that caused a great deal of consternation. So it would seem to be Carr, given my music, but right. Who knows? I wasn't there. But supposedly, this was a star-crossed production. You say it's a flop, Michael, and you're absolutely correct. It did lose money. However, it did run a year.
Yeah,
and that was rare in those days. Usually in a year, you paid back. Today, yes, of course, your investors might get 5 to 10% if you run a year. But nevertheless, it didn't pay back its investment, which is, to me, always will be the definition of a hit or a flop. You got to pay back. I don't care how long you run. I don't care what notices you get. Bottom line to me is the bottom line, and you are a hit if you pay back. And yes, so you're right, Michael. It was not a hit, but nevertheless, it did run a year.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, because I always thought that, but it's good to be here. I always assumed was Duby and Carr, but maybe it
wasn't. No, it definitely isn't. No question about that.
But, definitely is not.
It's definitely not Duby and Carr.
But that one, that song was in it from the beginning, wasn't it?
It was in it certainly from opening night on Broadway.
Oh, okay. Okay. Interesting. Okay.
But during the tryout in Philadelphia, the international set yet was the song that audiences were hearing. But the Merm didn't. This was a show she was doing because her marriage was in trouble. She had to have something to do. Let me go to work. She had already announced that she was retired, that type of thing. So, the one thing that Walter Kerr said about it was, what kind of Merman show is it if Merman never gets to stop the show, not once? And there's something to be said for that. She doesn't have one great standout number. But, we're going to have a much more affection for this show this time around because you're going to get that homage to Merman through Clea Blackhurst, who, yes, has done a tribute show to Merman over the years. And, the idea of a musical about Grace Kelly's wedding, that's sort of retro charming. I remember the day Grace Kelly died, and a friend called me and said, well, that's it for Happy Hunting. We'll never see it again. But, you know, time and distance after all, you know. So so here it is again, and it will strike us as very pleasant.
Well, I'm sure I mentioned this before, but I saw a high school production back in – it was either 79 or 80 that was done by directed by this nun on Staten Island who was very much into not doing the same old shows over and over again. And so that – I mean, I remember stories of how the parts looked – absolutely, like as if no one had used them before, sure. You know, because no one ever rents the show. But that was great because aside from everything else, that high school used to do shows with full orchestras. So yeah. I got to hear it with a full orchestra, and I don't think many people who didn't see the original can say that. Also, the point that I started to make before was that because of the disappointment the disappointing run and also the all of the tourists with the show. This was supposedly why Merman balked at having Stephen Sondheim write the music and the lyrics for Gypsy, which at one point was what was supposed to happen, why Julie Stein was brought in, and that turned out so incredibly well for everyone concerned. So that's an interesting historical point. And then there was also the tremendous apparently hatred or whatever between Merman and her leading man Fernando Lamas, and all of these very juicy stories about horrible onstage behavior on his part. So it you know, for a minor show, it kind of had a lot of a lot of repercussions to it.
You're right. Yeah, one can't imagine that the Gypsy score would have turned out better had Sondheim written the music, but who knows? Of course, we do know that one song from Gypsy, You'll Never Get Away From Me, was lifted from I'm in Pursuit of Happiness from the TV musical Ruggles of Red Gap. Right. So we know that the melody came first in that way, but one has to wonder how many of the Gypsy songs actually had Sondheim writing lyrics first and handing them to Julie. Maybe some, maybe all of the rest.
Yeah.
No. But the point is, when Sondheim was writing those lyrics, if he was writing lyrics first, he obviously had melodies in his head. I'd love to hear them.
Well, I've always thought that one of the great things about the score for Gypsy is probably that it represents two unbelievably talented people with basically maybe two different sensibilities. Is it fair to say? I mean, a real old school, you know, sure. Tradition. With this, you know, brilliant newcomer who would go on to forge, you know, amazing new paths for the musical theater, and the way that they worked with each other, it's really quite, you know, I mean, it seems so obvious to say at this point, it's an extraordinary score.
Mm. Which nobody can deny.
So let's wrap up this section on the Mufti discussion by saying that 2x2 is playing in a couple of days. It's
right.
February 15th.
And by the way, Martin Charnin, who wrote the lyrics, is directing it too.
Exactly, yes. Mm. It's playing the 15th through the 17th. Hollywood Pinafore is March 1st through the 3rd. Happy Hunting is March 15th through the 17th. And Silk Stockings is March 22nd to the 24th. So
yes.
Especially if you want to see 2x2, you got to get on the stick right away.
Yes.
and
well,
get over there.
Well, the other thing, too, is we were talking about the troubles that went on with Happy Hunting, but it's very interesting. Here's another troubled show from the vantage point that after its star, Danny Kaye, injured his knee, he started fooling around with the script tremendously. Certainly, when I saw 2x2 in its tryout in New Haven, everybody believed in it 100%. It wasn't the show that wound up on Broadway on opening night. There were many songs that were cut and songs that were written. But nevertheless, I thought it had tremendous potential. It's not a great show, no, and I think even its authors would admit that. However, I think it's a far better show and a far better score than people give it credit for, and I think it's going to pick up some fans this weekend at the York.
All right. Next up on our discussion is going to be our upcoming openings for this season. We have a lot of stuff happening soon. starting off with March 3rd, Cinderella, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, at the Broadway Theater. So when are you guys going to go see this? Is it up on your schedules yet, or is it too far out?
Not by this yet, but I think Cinderella's score is, though there aren't as many songs in it, I'm talking about the original now in 1957, as a full score that Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote. I think the quality is certainly as good as their best work, and I've always adored this score. So as a result, I am certainly looking forward to hearing it at the Broadway Theater. We're going to hear some other songs too, and certainly the book has been reworked. People I know who have seen it, some have loved, some have hated. No question about that. They've ruined it. Oh, what a great idea. Oh, they made it more significant. You know, so I don't know.
And that was the same person.
Yeah, different times of the day.
So, have you heard anything about whether this would be going to be considered in the revival category or a new show? Or
I think it'll be a revival. A few years ago, they decided if a show's been around a while, whether or not it's played Broadway, it's a revival. You know, there was a big production at New York City Opera some years ago, so it's not like it's been unknown in this town. And God knows it's played plenty of regional theaters. It was a paper mill a few years ago as well.
I don't know, but interesting. I think that they might make the book eligible for a tour.
Sure, and that's fair. That's fair, because supposedly there's been frankly, from what I hear, there's so little of the original Hammerstein book, or even the Joseph Wood Crutch rewrite in 1965. This show has been done three times on TV, and the only thing that can rival that is Once Upon a Mattress. So it's ironic that both Rogers shows, though very different Rogers, had the most TV airings, I think, of any musical. I'm guessing that's got to be right. I think Douglas Carter Beane will be eligible. Whether or not he'll get nominated is another story, right. But it's eligible, I would think so.
But at any rate, Peter, thank you for saying that about the score. I'm a little taken aback. I hear some people referring to the show, the property in general, as like second rate or I mean, I'm not the score. I mean, the score is, I think it's better than Me and Juliet. I think it's better than Pipe Dream. I love that score. I think it's great.
I do too.
Coming up after that is March 7th. We have Anne at the Beaumont, which is about former Texas governor, Anne Richards.
Yeah, one-person show there. That doesn't happen very often. Alan Alda was there with QED, but that's a big stage for one person.
I wonder how they're going to I assume they're just going to limit the stage in some way.
Yeah, good point.
As they did with the Gershwin for 1776. Remember when the Roundabout Theater Company said, we're going to Iris down the stage for 1776 when they put it in Gershwin. After that, March 14th is Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike, which was off Broadway that we talked about previously a few weeks ago in the podcast.
A good play. Chris Drang hasn't had much luck on Broadway, but we'll see if this changes that. Really, dating history, American film, Sex and Longing, Beyond Therapy. None of these plays lasted very long. We'll see if the Broadway theater goer is caught up with his sensibility and appreciates him more now.
I hope so. It's so hilarious.
And then on March 20th, possibly Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Possibly, yes. They raised the money, So again, which of us will be going to that and not thinking of Mary Tyler Moore and Richard Chamberlain and what that might have been? So I've always regretted that David Merrick didn't open the 1966 musical, because if he had, there would have been an original cast album. We since have had a wonderful album by Robert Sher, a terrific album, a two-disc set with every song that apparently ever made it to the stage or maybe even rehearsal. And it's a very, very good album. I saw the show when it was trying out as Holly Go Lightly, and it was a mess, no question about it. But nevertheless, it's going to be impossible for me to see a straight play version of Breakfast at Tiffany's without thinking of the musical, while there'll be plenty of people who will have to be thinking of Audrey Hepburn in the movie.
Right.
After that, we have Hands on a Hard Body, which is opening up the next day, March 21st, at the Atkinson.
And wasn't there some question there too? But I think they've fixed it? Weren't they having some
up? So at least they're that far along.
Yeah. This is a musical that came through La Jolla, did it?
Or yes.
La Jolla, and played on the West Coast. And I think the only person off the top of my head I can remember is Jen Cody's in it. But we'll have to see. This is a musical about a contest where various people have to touch, keep their hand on this truck, and if the last person to keep their hand on the truck wins the truck, which is sort of like Steel Pier updated.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Right. Hunter Foster and is also in it, and J.R.
That's right.
Johnson.
Yeah. After that, April 1st is our lucky guy at the Broadhurst with who's that guy? Tom Hanks? Is that
mm-hmm.
someone?
Mm-hmm.
Who was in the news last week about some extraordinarily favorable terms for his contract. Seems
yes, they were. Weren't they?
he's guaranteed $75,000 a week, and they feel like it'll be more along the lines of $150,000 a week. And if the show goes on without him, he will receive 2% of the box office after he leaves, which is interesting.
Right, but that's not going to happen, is it?
Who knows? Maybe it's good. It could be.
Bring Ben Affleck and Matt Damon into it, or maybe Usher or somebody. somebody really huge like Tom Hanks is.
Well, you'd have to.
Yes, indeed. That's the problem with having a star. You know, you got to get at least a bigger star to do that, and that doesn't always happen. It was amazing back in the 70s when Richard Burton took over in Equus. I mean, such a thing had never happened.
Right.
A star of even greater magnitude. Nothing against Anthony Hopkins, who, of course, need me to tell you, is an amazing actor. However, in terms of stature and achievement at that point, not since, mind you, but at that point, Richard Burton was far more well-known and far more accomplished than Anthony Hopkins had been, at least to the average Broadway theater goer.
Right.
Well, it's going to be a little horse race there to see, you know, if it meets the expectations. People have very high expectations for at least the box office of this show. We'll see what happens there. Followed up after Lucky Guy on April 4th is Kinky Boots at the Hirschfeld, which is...
Yeah, this is interesting because Cyndi Lauper has written the score, and Lord knows she's not a Broadway baby. However, Harvey Fierstein is, and as a result, it's not impossible that he has said to her, look, take it from a four-time Tony winner. Here's what has to happen in this song. I'm not saying any of this has happened. I'm hoping it's happened, frankly. I think a first-time theater writer, whatever the reputation in the pop world, could profit from listening to somebody who's won four Tony Awards and has been a theater animal for a long, long time.
And he has been had a nice little streak of success recently, hasn't he?
Sure.
So hopefully he can have lightning strike again. Now, if lightning strikes, what do you guys think about this theory? Can lightning strike for multiple shows at once, or is the lightning strike... Does it suck all the air out of the room for the other productions, you know, like...
Interesting question.
You know, like Book of Mormon, it seems like there's that one runaway hit, the Book of Mormon, the producers, what was the Monty Python one?
Spamalot.
Like Spamalot. And Spamalot ran a lot shorter than I thought it was going to be, given how hot it was when it first opened.
Well, you know, traditionally... And the Book of Mormon seems to be belying what I'm about to say. But traditionally, the shows that are funny don't tend to run as long as the shows that really tug at your heart. Mm. And I think that's one reason why the producers didn't run as long as 12 Tony Awards and Unanimous Raves would have led us to believe it would have run. Traditionally, that's all I'm saying. The Book of Mormon certainly is proving that wrong. See, the feeling is that people tend to go back to shows that tug at their heart, and they go to see funny shows once because they got the jokes. And now, you know, going back again, when you know the jokes, it's not going to be as funny. But yeah,
it's interesting.
I mean,
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because there was just a story, an article, a feature in the Times about people who are repeat viewers of the musical once. And they can't see it once. They go back and back because it's tugging at their heartstrings. And this might be also the formula for success that Rent had, was that and that Wicked has. Mm-hmm. And that Phantom has. So I think you might be onto something there, Felicia. Well, you might know something about theater.
Well, yes, and also as far as your the lightning strike, I mean, I think we can certainly think of some shows that did not get the attention maybe and did not run as long as they should have because maybe the all of the air was sucked out by other shows. For example, The Full Monty.
Oh yeah,
wasn't it the producers that?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
Earlier you mentioned Steel Pier. I think maybe maybe I'm wrong because I love the show overall despite its flaws. But I think maybe that would have been better received if Titanic, which had everyone thought was going to be a flop, hadn't mm-hmm. suddenly become this sleeper monster hit. I'm sure Peter can make a list of maybe seasons in which lightning has struck for more than one show. Probably shows of the past more than recent shows.
Well, the thing is that this is something that has only cropped up in recent years, that because X is a hit, Y suffers.
Right.
And it didn't seem to happen in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And I think the reason is that ticket prices were so much more reasonable then.
Yes. Yes.
I did an inflation calculation recently, and theater tickets that were $9.90 in the 60s should now be in the neighborhood of $50 to $60, and we know they're not. So as a result, that's the problem now. Sure, I guess the most happy fella suffered, and so did Bells Are Ringing, because My Fair Lady was running, sure. But nevertheless, for that era, Most Happy Fellas' 600-plus performances and Bells Are Ringing's 900-plus performances were awfully good runs. I think people really could afford to see more then than they do now, so I think that's really the big problem.
Absolutely.
Next up, after we were on Kinky Boots, is April 7th is the opening of the three-hander Orphans at the Schoenfeld. So, which is also, as far as I understand, a limited engagement starring Alec Baldwin.
Mm-hmm. And not only Alec.
Not only Alec. Haven't they? Am I incorrect? Didn't they already extend?
Have they?
Or if not, I've been reading that it's doing extremely well at the box office.
Sure.
Tough play.
Yeah.
Tough play. So we'll see how it fares in terms of, really. Who expected any tickets to be available for Glenn Ross?
Yeah.
And yet tickets are achievable and acquirable. And that's not nearly as tough a play as Orphan is.
From one extreme to the other, we go from Orphans to Matilda at the Schubert, which opens April 11th at the Schubert.
I can't say I'm a big fan of the score of Matilda, but oh, do I love the book about this little girl who's oppressed by stupid parents who have no idea what a gem they have in their hands. They love their equally stupid son, but they don't appreciate this little girl who loves learning. You bookworm, they say to her, as if they're saying, you asshole. Thank God for teachers. Thank God for librarians. They're the ones who save children like this, who aren't appreciated at home. It's a wonderful, wonderful story. And indeed, we find at the end of the story that Matilda knows two wrongs does not make a right. She turns out to be very good for her parents, even though they don't deserve it. So it's a very nice show all around.
Matilda, of course, is a runaway hit over in London as a transfer to Broadway. And there's a lot of people making parallels between Matilda and Harry Potter. Of course, in the Harry Potter scenario where he lives with his steps and under the steps with his steps. Sure. And after that, on April 14th, we have Motown the Musical at the Lunt. And so Motown has been in the news as well. They just announced that they've got some of their casting done. And And Mr. Riedel has been questioning whether or not they have a completed book yet. So we'll see. You know, it's been my experience is that in the development of new musicals that many of them that I hear have excellent music and the book is always the problem. So it seems to be, in my experience, the book is always a challenge for new works. What do you guys think?
Certainly, that's a time-honored theory. What's going to happen here, I think Motown would have had an easier time if there were no such thing as Jersey Boys, but I think it's going to be tremendously compared to that. And that's a tough thing to be compared to, because Jersey Boys is an excellent show. Jersey Boys does lick the problem of a book, because Jersey Boys' book is extraordinarily good. And yet they got such a good break because the name of the show, of the group was the Four Seasons. If they had been the Four Lads, it wouldn't have occurred to these people to split the show into four seasons itself. Spring, summer, winter, and fall. It really helped them immeasurably to have that structure in place just from the name of the group that they're celebrating. So I have a feeling that Motown will be compared to Jersey Boys, and that's quite a challenge.
Something, one of the most interesting things about Motown is that the latest casting announcement was that they have found two young men to share the roles, well, to share, how could I phrase it? Each actor is playing three different characters, young Berry Gordy, Michael Jackson, and Stevie Wonder, which I guess, you know, they had to do something in order to keep the cast size down. As it is, it's quite a large cast. I'm looking at it now. It's quite a large cast. But yeah, so Jabril Maury, Mawry, and Raymond Luke Jr. are going to be alternating in those three roles, to play not one, not two, but three icons. That's quite something, isn't it?
Yes.
Next up after that, April 14th opening of Motown is the April 15th opening of The Nance, which is Douglas Carter Beane's new show starring none other than Nathan Lane. So I'm assuming that this will be a very funny show. Can I assume that?
I think so. There's every reason to believe that.
I think so too, but it sounds like it's going to go for the – I mean, I hope so. It's going to go for a little bit for the dark side too, because it's about a stock figure that used to be in the theater of a very effeminate actor, you know, who's what his life is like on stage and off, and I imagine that Nathan Lane would want to explore the more serious side of it also.
The question will be, will Nathan Lane get a Tony nomination? It's been amazing how many shows he's appeared in a row where that hasn't happened. I don't mean the award, I mean nomination. So I don't know if we've learned to take him for granted or what, but nevertheless, we'll see if he breaks the streak that's been going on for quite some time now.
The next up after The Nance on April 16th is The Big Knife at American Airlines, which is a roundabout theater presentation about Clifford Odette's tale about keeping your integrity in the face of success. What do we think? Bobby Carnevale is going to be in this?
Well, what's really something is when was the last time we had two Odette's plays in the same season, Golden Boy on Broadway? And don't forget, The 2x2 is an adaptation of a Clifford Odette's play,
right?
The Flowering Peach. So Odette's is having a good year. I think The Flowering Peach, though, I don't know this for sure, and I can be easily corrected, but I think that was the play that one critic wrote the marvelous line, "Odette's, where is thy sting?" Meaning that he was writing plays of social significance as he once had. A good line.
Next up after that is The Assembled Parties at the Friedman, which is Richard Greenberg's new show about a affluent Jewish family on the Upper West Side. And it stars Judith Light and Jessica Hecht. I love Jessica Hecht. I love Judith Leith too, but I don't see Jessica Hecht around as much.
Right.
It's funny, when I was in Texas a few weeks ago, I was in a video store and I ran into a DVD of Harvey, a TV production from 1997, which I had seen back in 1997 on TV in a Dayton hotel room. And I didn't realize Jessica Hecht was in this TV production in which Harry Anderson played Elwood and Swoosie Kurtz played Vita. But Jessica Hecht was Nurse Kelly in that production. So interesting that, of course, she showed up not that long ago in Harvey, this time playing Vita. So she obviously had quite a head start on playing Vita from having been in that TV production.
So after that we have the national tour of Jekyll and Hyde is making a stop at the Marquee. And we've talked about that in previous weeks, whether or not that's going to be – they've changed theaters. What theater were they originally in? They were
in the Rogers.
Rogers originally. Mm-hmm. Now they're at the Marquee. So we'll see what happens with that. It seems as though that we had much higher hopes for it, and it's not being received so well out on tour, but we'll see what happens in New York. On April 21st, Macbeth is coming into the Barrymore. And that's the Alan Cumming one-man production, play all the roles, totally exhausted afterwards. In fact, I think that he's not doing an eight-show week, isn't that? He's doing a six-show week or something along those lines. And it's a limited engagement. And it had he had done it somewhere else before. I'm not
Wasn't it the Lincoln Center Festival?
Maybe it was. Maybe it was, or I was thinking
I
think the Lincoln Center Festival, but before that he did it at Edinburgh. I'm not sure.
Oh, okay.
Not sure if he did it at Edinburgh.
Yeah, that sounds right.
April 22nd, The Testament of Mary at the Kerr is coming in there, and we should see this is a story about Mary, the mother of Jesus, and she tells her side of the story. And it's starring Fiona Shaw. What do we think that this is? It's a limited engagement. It's going to be closing June 16th. But what do we think about this?
Well, I guess it will help people who have always wanted to know more about what Immaculate Conception is, which most people do have a different conception of what that term means than what it really means. I'll let Mary explain it to you as time goes on. But don't be surprised if you go there and say, oh, wait a minute, I thought Immaculate Conception was. But sure, I want to hear Mary's side of the story. Of course, the problem with dealing with God figures is the fact that you got to be awfully good, you know, to write about religious matters. You run the risk, certainly, of infuriating those people who have staunch religious beliefs, who believe there is only one way the story should be told, and that's already been told in that big bestseller, that book by Mr. Gideon, as Laura Lively once referred to it. This could be one of the more controversial events of the season. It's not impossible the limited engagement will be more limited than they think. That's also a risk, I think, of a one-man Macbeth, too. We'll see.
The next thing up on April 21st, April 23rd, is the trip to the Bountiful at the Stephen Sondheim, which has quite a cast. Cicely Tyson, Cuba Gooding Jr., Vanessa Williams, Condola Rashad. And this is a story about an aging widow who leaves her son and daughter in a small Houston apartment to visit the home where she grew up.
The now pretty much forgotten Joe Van Fleet, who ironically enough showed up in one of those Cinderellas on TV as the wicked stepmother, who won an Oscar for East of Eden, won a Tony for playing the role in The Trip to Bountiful, which was a play that was pretty much forgotten until that movie version came some years ago and did awfully well by Geraldine Page. She got an Oscar, didn't she, Michael? Does that sound right?
Yeah, I seem to remember oddly enough, I seem to remember F. Murray Abraham presenting it to her.
Uh-huh.
Or announcing her.
Yeah. All right. After that, we're coming towards the end with April 24th. I'll Eat You Last, a chat with Sue Engers, which is about the famous Hollywood personality, and it's at the Booth. So, and this is starring, of course, Bette Midler. So, I'm sure that this is going to have a, especially being so close to the Tony Awards and all the excitement, this will be very exciting just because of all the colorful personalities involved. But will it be a good show that goes for the long run?
I'm very surprised they want the Booth, which is the second smallest theater on Broadway. I would have thought they would have felt that Bette Midler would be able to bring in more than 750 people a night. So I'm a little surprised at that. But this could be one that could really be the season's biggest hoot. We shall see.
And then finally, April 25th is Pippin at the Music Box, the much-heralded American Repertory Theater production.
I may have said this already, but reports from Boston have been unanimously enthusiastic, but almost everybody doesn't like one person in the show. It's never the same person, it seems to me. Oh, I love the show, but the person playing X, terrible. You know, so while other people said, oh, I love the person playing X, but the person playing Y, oh my God, they got to get rid of that person. What are you talking about? Y was great. Get rid of Z. I mean, so, but
well,
anyway,
I
love the production, and that's the important thing.
I had heard that too, Peter, and I was wondering if anyone might be replaced, but I believe it was this week they announced that the entire cast is coming.
Good.
Yeah. One thing that we didn't mention that you might be wondering where it's at is that Pump Boys is not going to be coming this season. They've they pulled the plug Wednesday or Thursday this week on Pump Boys. They said the landscape is too crowded. I think that's what they said. So
and
they said they want
to less crowded than anybody could have expected it to be.
Yeah, and they're going to bring. They say they're going to bring it in next season. So we'll have to see. You know,
producers say that, don't they? And then they let us forget about them, you know, quietly. The wonderful thing about Puppet Boys originally was the fact that you had the authors of the show performing. And there's always something wonderful about seeing performers do their own work. Not that Pump Boys doesn't have a lot of charm in its own rustic way, but nevertheless, there's something extra special about seeing performers do their own work. And without that, Pump Boy does lose a little bit of its appeal. So although the wonderful thing is getting Circle in the Square, that's a very nice venue for a show like this.
Yes.
Very nice indeed. This leaves Circle without a booking, which is too bad because that means it will have been empty for a year. So it's always sad when a theater has to go that long without a booking.
You know, I would think that the thing about Pump Boys is that they should think about, I would seriously think about touring Pump Boys in areas where Pump Boys will be well received and then bring it into Broadway as a possible limited engagement. I think that would be a smarter way to go. Bo Bice, who starred in American Idol, or was one of the winners, I believe, of American Idol, or finalist at least. He's a very, very popular performer, and perhaps they could tour in areas that he's very popular in and then try to bring it to Broadway next season. I think that would be a smarter plan for Pump Boys than to open cold on Broadway. So that's about it. What's coming up for you guys this season?
This week?
This week, excuse me. This season. Well, we'll start with this week.
Sure. As I mentioned earlier, I'm going, I believe, to the Good Person of Szechuan on Tuesday. I'm going to Patty Issues, which I haven't seen yet. That's on the horizon for me. There may be something else as time goes on.
Michael, what's happening this week? Anything you
Peter,
want?
I think you're really going to enjoy Patty Issues. I hadn't realized you hadn't seen it yet. I think you're going to love it.
Yeah,
it's very good.
We had Ben on a few months ago. Peter, were you there for the Ben?
No,
you were at.
And I like Ben. I've known Ben a long time, and he's a very smart guy.
And he apparently also is really good at PR, which is not his, which not technically.
Yes, he certainly is. Well, let me tell you something else I'm doing, and that is tomorrow night I'll be running a panel discussion at NYU on City of Angels at 6:30 prior to the 8 o'clock performance of City of Angels. This is the 1990 Tony winner as Best Musical, and they're doing it at the Frederick Lowe Theater, and their productions are pretty good. So anyway, if you want to drop by at 6:30, I'll be talking to members of the original cast who will be there, and we'll discuss what it was like on a day-to-day basis going through rehearsals and previews with no out-of-town tryout, which was still something that was happening in those days, especially with the big Cy Coleman, Larry Gelbart musical. You would think that they – but it was such a complicated production set-wise with really – two completely different series of sets, one in color, one in black and white, that they had to start from scratch and just stay there. So so we'll talk about that tomorrow night. If anybody's in the neighborhood, do drop in.
Wasn't City of Angels one of the first big musicals that Fran and Barry produced as lead producers?
I don't think so. It could be, but that, those names.
No, that doesn't sound right to me either. Maybe we're both wrong.
Yeah, it could be. But
No, probably if please, if I'm right and both of you are wrong, then something's very backwards.
No, don't feel that way.
But I heard great things about the NYU City of Angels, and for $20 a ticket. Go and see a big orchestra and some great talent, absolutely. Get down there and see it.
Their Fiorello was at least as good as the Encores one, I would say.
All righty. So I want to say a thank you to a handful of people who have really helped out in the last couple of weeks. Jared Good has been transcribing podcasts for us, and we've been putting them up as he's been transcribing them. Courtney Rice also has been transcribing over the last couple of years, and she has done a huge benefit, and I really just realized that I've neglected to mention her personally, that she's been transcribing for a while. Mike Colford went back and reconnected, which I had not realized until he had emailed me, all the old episodes of This Week on Broadway. The links were broken when we moved from one host to another last year, and so lots of people were unable to get to the old shows, and Mike went back and reconnected all of them. So if in fact you wanted to listen to some of the old shows and you weren't able to, they should be working now, and if you have a problem, just drop me an email and we'll check it out and see what's going on, but I think they're back working. Other folks have offered to help us out with various different things like transcribing, and I will be getting in touch with you all about that. Of course, our show notes for a lot of the things that we have talked about in the show, we have links to them in our show notes each week, including ways in which to get in contact with Peter, Michael, and me. You can listen to This Week on Broadway on through BroadwayRadio.com, or you can go to iTunes to subscribe, which is really helpful to us if you subscribe and also leaves us some feedback on iTunes about the show, because that'll help other people find This Week on Broadway quicker. If you search in iTunes for Broadway, This Week on Broadway comes up, you know, fifth or sixth, and the five or six shows in front of us are shows that really haven't produced anything in years. So if you can subscribe and leave feedback, it'll push us up in the rankings. We'll get above those other shows that are no longer being produced. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If I had drowned, unless I had glorious technicolor, breathtaking cinemascope and stereo. If Ava Gardner played Godiva riding on a mare, the people wouldn't pay a cent to see her in the bear, unless she had glorious technicolor or cinecolor or warner color or pathé color.